You're listening to a programme from BBC Radio 4.
Hello, this is Steve Richards.
Welcome to the last week in Westminster of an extraordinary year. An election always brings about significant change, but the one in May triggered unexpected and tumultuous waves. The Conservatives won an overall majority against the expectations of the pollsters and indeed the leaders of the main parties. Labour lost and elected Jeremy Corbyn by a landslide, a left-wing backbencher very much on the front bench. Liberal Democrats were nearly wiped out and the SNP triumphed spectacularly. And there were many hidden twists and turns within that vivid big picture. I'll be reflecting on the year with two of the programme's presenters, Helen Lewis from The New Statesman and Isabel Hardman from The Spectator. We were all last in the studio together for the live programme that covered the election of Jeremy Corbyn in September. And I'll be also talking to two leaders whose parties face unrecognisably different challenges as a result of that general election. First, let's get a reminder of Cameron's upbeat victory statement. Only a few hours earlier, he had written a resignation speech and hoped at best to lead a coalition. And suddenly, he was the first Tory leader to win an overall majority since 1992.
I truly believe we're on the brink of something special in our country. We can make Britain a place where a good life is in reach for everyone who is willing to work and do the right thing. Our manifesto is a manifesto for working people, and as a majority government, we will be able to deliver all of it. Indeed, it is the reason why I think majority government is more accountable.
Isabel Hardman, it's interesting reflecting on what's happened to Cameron since then. Towards the end of the year, there's been quite a lot of criticism that he hasn't taken big decisions, whether it's to do with airports to some extent on some of the European issues. And he's had to row back on tax credits and all the rest of it. But it's still quite a radical government, for a government with a majority of 12.
Yes, he is managing to get quite a lot through. And he's also put people into really interesting positions, like Michael Gove in at Justice, doing a huge amount on prison reform, for instance. And Cameron, in his conference speech, also set out a social reform agenda for the next few years. So it's not as though he's just planning to try to sort of tread water until the next election. He's got plans. But we have seen the reality of governing with a very small majority, which is that he hasn't been able thus far to get human rights reform onto the statute book.
Yeah, they haven't even put it in a Queen's speech, have they?
No, and I suspect that it will end up being a sort of rose by any other name in order to say that they've done something, but something that will get past the considerable number of Conservative MPs who would vote down a radical reform of human rights legislation in this country.
Yeah, see, it's interesting, Helen Lewis. Where do you stand on this government? Is it one that is twisting and turning in a sort of rather weak way, partly because of its small majority? Or do you agree with a Labour MP who I spoke to, who was in some of the last Labour governments, who said they're being more daring than us with a majority of 180, which they had in, I think, one of their landslide governments?
I think they certainly found it more difficult than they expected, despite having a majority. I think one of the most interesting things that happened is you've almost seen Cameron Osborne almost mutate into kind of more like a president and a prime minister. So it doesn't feel sometimes like Cameron is very engaged in domestic politics. He's going out. He's doing the world stage stuff. He's kind of floating above the everyday business. Whereas, you know, Osborne feels very much like he is running the show on a kind of day-to-day basis in terms of, you know, votes in the Commons. And I think that's one of the things that will become an interesting theme of the Parliament ahead. But I agree with Isabel, you know, putting Gove in at Justice is a fascinating move, because I think it's fair to say he was hated mostly by teachers and by people in the education sector. He had a really tough time in that role. He saw himself actually as a very confrontational, oppositional kind of politician there. And now he's like sort of Liberals are having this terrible crisis where they're going, but Michael Gove seems to be doing things that we approve of. And I think that there will be quiet reforms like that. But I agree also that we are talking far too much about Europe. I mean, for my personal feeling, certainly. But generally, I think that is coming.
You better get used to it.
To crowd
out. There's going to be a lot more to come in
domestic policy.
Yeah. Does that explain Cameron's focus on international affairs? He's got no choice but to focus on it because of the centrality of the EU referendum. Or is it the case that he really is stepping back from a lot of the domestic agenda, or allowing George Osborne to shape it more directly?
I think he is allowing George Osborne to get very involved in the domestic agenda. The Treasury stages land grabs quite regularly on other departments' policy areas, and ministers often quite reluctantly give up their pet projects because suddenly it's become an Osborne pet project. I mean, housing is one example that Osborne really is setting policy on now, and the Department for Communities and Local Government is very much subservient to him. But I think it's probably unfair to say that Cameron is so distracted by international affairs that he's not interested in domestic reform. I was just so struck by his conference speech, by the focus that he put on social reform, on equality, on things that actually you probably expect a moderate Labour leader to be talking about, such as people from ethnic minorities getting jobs. And what I thought was particularly striking was that he got really roundly applauded by his party when he said that as well.
I think it's really interesting to see that there are some on the right of the Tory party who are annoyed. They think, come on, you've got an absolute majority now. They think, you know, Labour is very weak under Jeremy Corbyn. You know, why aren't you reviving the Thatcher project? Why are you giving these softly noises about inequality when this could be a radical right-wing government? And it's not really at the moment.
Well, Helen, you mentioned Jeremy Corbyn there in the context of Tory perceptions of fragility. It remains, of course, the most unexpected development of the year. I think more unexpected than the Conservatives' overall majority, his election. As I said earlier, we were all in the studio here as he was elected and made this victory speech. We're going to just hear a bit of it now.
I want to thank the fellow leadership candidates. We're discussing the number, whether it's 29, 35 or 39 hustings we've been to together since this election started. We'll discuss that later and exchange diaries. But it's been a fascinating experience for all of us. And I want to thank them for the way the debates were conducted, the way that we were able to put forward political debate and political differences and still come out at the end of it with a group hug.
And there we are. I think they then did have a kind of group hug. Now, there we have Jeremy Corbyn, a kind of convivial presence. And indeed, in some of his interviews, I think he comes over as a rather nice guy. By the end of the year, is he in a stronger position? I've read some people, including some at the New Statesman, Helen, saying that he is in a stronger position at the end of the year than he was when we heard that victory speech here in the studio in September.
I think he is. I think people talk about him as a kind of naive idealist, but actually he's made a series of extremely pragmatic decisions. For example, over the Syria vote, he could quite easily have said, I'm whipping this, we are voting against, and if you want to leave, get out. It might have, you know, been a show of strength that meant that they didn't stage the vote. It might also have meant that it was the end of his leadership. But in the end, I think he chose that he would rather continue to be Labour leader and maybe lose that vote than the other way around. So that is the action of a pragmatist, somebody who wants to be leader. I think people thought, well, you know, he doesn't really want to be leader. He'll probably just keep the seat warm until he hands over to someone in the next generation down. But actually what he's demonstrated is an appetite for staying in that job. And the Oldham West by-election, you know, really put a lid on top of all the coup talk, I think, because it was felt, well, you know, we are just going to look disloyal at this point. Nobody knows whether or not the rules mean that he would automatically get on the ballot again. It would be heinously embarrassing to try and stage a coup, him be on the ballot again and get elected again, probably with an even bigger majority.
But isn't it the case really? I mean, we in political journalism like to sort of pinpoint moments of drama and change, that actually nothing has changed since his election that day in September, that the basic fragility is still in place, that the MPs that day were alarmed by his election as the membership were thrilled by it, and at the end of the year, MPs remain alarmed and the membership broadly are thrilled with his leadership.
I think that's certainly the case for the sort of parliamentary and membership dynamics. So MPs are still alarmed and bewildered, and they still don't really have a plan about what to do if they want to get rid of Jeremy Corbyn, which many of them do. And the membership, the polls suggest, are still pretty happy with Jeremy Corbyn, and a large number of them think that if Jeremy Corbyn went, that Andy Burnham should replace him, which suggests that the Labour membership is in a very interesting place at the moment indeed. But I think Jeremy Corbyn has grown stronger over this term while his party has grown weaker. So the Labour Party...
His parliamentary party or
the Labour Party brand in general.
General.
Labour doesn't have a cogent position on anything at the moment. So Jeremy Corbyn will have one position on the Investigatory Powers Bill, which hands more powers to spies, while Andy Burnham is saying that he supports it. So on everything, including the Syria vote, there's no one position. And this is a political party. Why don't they just all stand as independents if they're not going to agree? They're not holding together as a unit. And that's going to get more and more obvious over the next few months. And We can't forget the electorate. The membership may be thrilled with Jeremy Corbyn, but the Labour membership is drawn from one section of society. The rest of society is unimpressed, the polls suggest.
And I think the other thing to remember is that there have been a large number of people have left the Labour Party, as well as the number of people have joined. So the membership is already, since his election actually, has moved even further to the left. And you are seeing in by-elections, for example, you know, large numbers of former Green voters going to the Labour Party now. So I think that that process also hasn't finished.
Yeah, well, it's going to be fascinating to see what happens to Labour over the next 12 months. The focus, of course, of a lot of media attention is the Cameron majority and the Labour Party. And these have been such compelling narratives that it's been easy to overlook in some ways the biggest change to the House of Commons, the election of 56 SNP MPs. When I interviewed the Speaker, John Bercow, in September, he told me that their presence, discipline and assiduous attendance of debates had struck him as the biggest change in this Parliament compared with the last. Its leader at Westminster, Angus Robertson, has seen his kind of role transformed from a tiny band of six MPs that he led, to one now of the third biggest party in a parliament where the government, as we've discussed, has this tiny majority. So I spoke to him and asked him what had changed most for him.
Well, first off, it's utterly transformational and in a number of different ways. Firstly, I have a lot of colleagues. That's great. It means that you can cover a lot more of what's going on in the chamber, in the debates. You're guaranteed in terms of your representation in the committees across the House of Commons. I have two questions guaranteed every week in Prime Minister's question time. And when the government has only got a majority of 12 and on some issues can't guarantee that majority, you become a very relevant player.
How does it work? Because you are the leader of the Westminster Parliamentary Party. Nicola Sturgeon is leader of your party overall. You've also got a former leader back with you at Westminster, Alex Salmond. Who takes the decisions as to what you do as MPs in the House of Commons? Is it you? Is it Nicola Sturgeon? Does Alex Salmond like to have a big input? How does all that work?
Well, first off, we're a functioning political party, unlike the Labour Party, which seems to be turning in three different directions at the same time. And we're a democratic political party. So when the really big issues that come up, we discuss them in the Westminster SNP group. We liaise with our colleagues in the Scottish Government and the SNP leadership nationally, but we are one and the same party. We have a North Star. We know where we're trying to get to. We understand how we're trying to do it. And that perhaps makes it a little bit easier. We're very collegial. We get on with one another.
Now, you mentioned your ultimate goal. You know what you're all in this for, which is incredibly ironic. I interviewed the Speaker of the Commons, John Bercow, in September and asked him what had stood out most for him in the new House of Commons. And he said it was the discipline of your party and the degree to which you, as a parliamentary party, attend debates and all the rest of it, and yet you don't want to be here. And, I mean, that is, in the end, bizarre, isn't it? You seem to quite like the politics of the House of Commons, and yet your ultimate goal is to get the hell out of there as soon as possible.
I think the best way to understand it is that we are Democrats, and I think we have a job to do. We've been elected to represent our constituents, and notwithstanding the fact that we want to fundamentally alter the way in which decisions are made for Scotland, so long as we haven't got to where we want to get to, we have to work constructively, and that's exactly what we're doing. I think it reflects more on the rest of Westminster, though, the irony that it is seen as being something odd that a political party actually turns up for debates. Imagine that. Or that when somebody says something that one agrees with, that one might clap, as opposed to braying like horses.
He stopped you for clapping, didn't he? Although, well, since you all clapped various speeches, Hilary Benn has been clapped, so it's obviously become more of a fashion in there.
Well, perhaps the precedent has changed. My colleagues were told off for applauding something that I'd said, but I don't think there was any injunction for Tories to stop clapping Hillary Benn. Maybe things are changing.
What have been the difficult side in a moment of end-of-year candour from you of managing a much bigger party?
The biggest change about going from six to more than 50 parliamentarians is most of your colleagues do not have direct experience of an institution that uses very arcane rules and operates in very curious ways. For the first time, we're able to take part in debates and committee meetings on subjects that we've never had the resources in terms of personnel to be able to do so. And now we have people with experience and they're able to plug in directly. And it's a work in progress. It's the start of a parliament. We've got many more challenges to come in the new year, issues like the European Union referendum.
Since you mentioned that, and you raised it in the last Prime Minister's questions, you are a pro-EU membership party, and yet there must be a bit of you that thinks if Britain votes to pull out, that would trigger the second referendum on independence that is your ultimate goal. I mean, there must be a bit of you that kind of hopes the referendum is for out.
I can say, hand on heart, there is not a single bit of me that wishes the rest of the UK to leave the European Union. The minute England might vote to leave the European Union, the problems for Scotland, but for Wales, for Northern Ireland and the Irish Republic will be massive. It is concerning to see in this week about a very, very large piece of research done about public opinion, which showed a very strong majority in Scotland for remaining in the EU, but sadly a growing trend of Euroscepticism in England. I hope we will have a case made why it's important to remain within the EU. Unfortunately, I think this government has been totally mishandling the negotiations and not making the case why it is a good thing to play our part with our European neighbours and allies.
Would it trigger a referendum in Scotland, do you think, if we pulled out?
Well, the First Minister has said there would have to be material changes to the circumstances of the 2014.
Well, this would be a very big
material change. Of course, we were told in Scotland that people should vote no to Scottish independence because otherwise we'd be outside the European Union. And here we are just over a year later being told that we might be taken out of the European Union against our democratic will.
So it would trigger, you
Well, it's going to, it would be a huge problem. And I think there's every likelihood that it could trigger a referendum. A referendum will only happen if people want it to happen, point one, and two, if there is a clear majority for independence. What's the point of having a second referendum on a subject if it's unlikely to be a changed outcome? And thirdly, and most importantly of all, we should respect the result of the 2014 referendum. And in current circumstances, people are not by majority supporting Scottish independence.
Angus Robertson, leader of the SNP at Westminster, reflecting on a year which has seen his party grow from 6 MPs before the election to 56 now. Isabel Hardman, it is striking at times, we were talking earlier about some of the Labour's problems about adopting a coherent line on policy. At times they've seemed like a kind of more coherent opposition, haven't they? United, say, against the tax credit cuts, united against bombing Syria, whereas Labour have had their famous internal conflicts about these policies.
Yes, well, and SNP MPs have signed an agreement that they don't criticise their party in public as well, which I don't think Jeremy Corbyn would manage with his own MPs.
That's a discipline that only other leaders could dream of.
Yeah, well, exactly. It was really striking that the whole party united to vote against airstrikes on Islamic State in Syria. And I was talking to a couple of SNP MPs afterwards, and I was saying, I can't believe that you didn't have a few in your number who had doubts about your party's position. And they said, well, actually, that wasn't a difficult decision, but it's issues like fracking where the party is really split, and on the economy as well, because the party is united, obviously, over independence, perhaps united on issues of defence. But when it comes to other big issues like energy and the economy, actually, there are much wider range of views in the party, yet still they will remain united when it comes to votes, I suspect.
Yeah, fracking is interesting because both Esma and I went to SNP conference, and it was one of the few things where it looked for a moment as if there might be some kind of actual debate before it was quickly snuffed out in the range of another kind of great VT of some people cheering about Scotland. I think I'm probably going to get a lot of hate for saying this online, but I think the SNP at Westminster haven't actually been that interesting for the exact reason that Isabel's outlined.
Well, almost too disciplined.
That they are relentlessly on message. What's more interesting to look at is the SNP government in Holyrood, and we've got big elections coming up there in 2016. They've got really big problems in Scotland, things that could be laid at their door, and so far they've managed always to avoid them. For example, the Forth Road Bridge closure, that is a major artery going into Edinburgh. Imagine if, for people in London, that the M25 was closed. David Cameron would be up every day getting barrages of questions about it. But so far, the SNP seem to be bulletproof up there. And I think they're pretty bulletproof at Westminster as well. And that will be interesting to see whether or not that endures next year.
Well, of course, there are hugely important elections for the Scottish Parliament. Let's look finally at the Liberal Democrats. It's an extraordinary story again, in reverse, really, compared with the SNP. A party in power at Westminster until May, now reduced to a group of 8 MPs. Its new leader, Tim Farron, struggling to get called at Prime Minister's questions very often. I put it to Tim Farron that in some ways he's in the oddest position of all the party leaders. He secured that personal goal of winning a leadership contest, but in an impossibly dark context.
Well, it is what it is. Early on in my time as leader, literally about 2 days afterwards, I cut the ribbon on some new affordable housing we'd built in our council area up in South Lakeland. And the architect there, who's a wonderful and very blunt woman, who said, I'd much rather be in your position than the Labour leader. I said, oh, well, why is that? She said, well, I want to build a really good new building. I like the previous one to be raised to the ground first. And there is, you know, it is what it is. I was devastated by the result. I expected it to be bad, just not as bad as it was. But the job we have now is to punch above our weight, puff our chests out, Trudeau style, and claim a place in British politics that I think we need to fill. There needs to be a Liberal alternative. And so I took on the role in the middle of July. My job is to rebuild across the country and to create a space for us and to assume a place that perhaps the House of Commons arithmetic wouldn't naturally give us.
Just on that House of Commons arithmetic, it's interesting. I was speaking to somebody who voted for you and has worked at quite a high level in your party in the past. And I asked him about whether he thought Labour MPs might defect and all the rest of it. And he said, the problem is that figure eight. Just eight MPs. If it was over 20, it might seem like a credible, attractive vehicle to others. But that figure of eight is the killer.
Well, I can't say that thought hasn't ever crossed my mind. But having said all that, the figures are what they are. And you look at the British political market, you might think it's quite crowded, you know, however many political parties there are gaining a slice of the pie. But actually, if you then start looking at where those people are and the space they occupy, so there are nationalists, there are socialists, there's a Conservative Party, there is a vast space for a Liberal Party in British politics, bigger actually than there was before the general election, ironically. And I mentioned Trudeau, and I mention him for lots of reasons. One is that he became Prime Minister of Canada just a couple of months ago from third place, and from quite a distant third place. And he did that by clearly marking out his territory, and then, irrespective of the number of MPs he had, just elbowing his way into the narrative and taking advantage and speaking to people in a way that resonated. Mm. And you've got to think, who is out there who can speak about the long term, who's going to try and tackle climate change, the housing crisis? And that's what the Liberal Democrats are going to be for.
Do you envisage at some point, I mean, this is the eternal discussion, of course, but perhaps more urgent now than, from your perspective, than at any other point, that there has to be a coming together in some form or other of the non-conservative parties? Is that your thinking, that you will have conversations with Labour, with whoever, but that will be in some shape or other the hazy distant future?
Well, I think it is good to talk, and that includes to people in the Conservative Party who are progressive and long-term minded, and there are some. My sense, though, is that in this Parliament, there are going to be two very important opportunities for, we'll call them sensible progressives, to talk together and to work together. One, we don't have to create the opportunity for, which is the EU referendum, which is very, very likely to be in this coming year. And the other is the prospect of electoral reform. On the EU especially, I think what I notice about the movement around Jeremy Corbyn is it's not very internationalist. It's quite isolationist. It's anti-free trade. And it's at best sceptical about the European Union. So whilst I don't expect them to campaign against the EU, I don't expect them to be bothering too much about campaigning for it. And so those people who are moderate, progressive people in the Labour Party will find in the Liberal Democrats people who want to work with them and share similar goals.
How frustrating, finally, has it been in the House of Commons? I mean, it is such a contrast, isn't it, from being a party of government to one that struggles for its leader to get called for Prime Minister's questions.
First of all, I'm very sceptical about the House of Commons, and it is a place where great things can happen, a place where you can raise very important points and get things done for your constituents and to build a case across the country. But it's also a place of great pomposity, a lot of wasted words, and it's more theatre than it is any good. So I was Min Campbell's PPS when he was our leader, when we had two questions a week and the rest of it. And it occurred to me we wasted a vast amount of time
preparing
on something that really didn't do anybody any good whatsoever. My job is to talk to people like you and to get out there and talk to everybody else. And I think the House of Commons is something that is an obsession for a relatively small number of people, and it has very little to say about normal life out there, and my job is to connect with normal life.
Tim Farron, listening to him, Helen Lewis, I mean, we were focusing earlier on some of the winners, personal winners. David Cameron won the election, Corbyn won the leadership. But politics has been a brutal business this year, hasn't it? When you think about this time a year ago, Ed Miliband, hoped and I think thought he would be Prime Minister. Ed Balls thought he could well be Chancellor of the Exchequer in some government.
Yeah, I went to Paisley and, you know, Douglas Alexander thought he might be Foreign Secretary, and then he got a 16,000 majority completely defeated by a 20-year-old.
Yeah, it has been a tough year for those who went into it with expectations. I mean, the opposite has happened. And the Liberal Democrats were in power at this time a year ago.
I also think the interesting thing about it is how much of politics this year, particularly since the election, has been shaped by small random decisions. It really is that kind of butterfly effect. So think of the effect of, for example, the tax credits and the welfare bill on the Labour leadership election. The fact that Jeremy Corbyn was the one saying, no, I wouldn't abstain, I would vote against, provided such a clear line of differentiation from the other three. I think that really swayed people. The same thing about the Liberal Democrats deciding to have a mercifully short leadership election. They elected somebody in Tim Farron, who is on very much on the left of the party. I'm not sure whether or not if you re-ran it again in the knowledge that Jeremy Corbyn would be Labour leader, you would get the same result in that case, actually, because Norman Lamb, who he was standing against, was much more of the kind of classic Liberal tradition. And that does seem to be now, Tim Farron is kind of now gently nudging the party back towards that. For example, they voted in favour of airstrikes on Syria, whereas, you know, one of the massive drivers of people voting for the Lib Dems during the 2000s was their opposition to the Iraq War. So they're in a very difficult space, I think.
Do you think finally, Isbaham, this year has seen kind of deep trends that Britain, or certainly England, is moving to the right again and has voted a Conservative majority government? Or has it been more, as Helen suggests, sort of butterfly effects? You know, say the election was swung at the last moment by the rise of the SNP. It wasn't about England moving to the right. That it could have been a different Labour leader if certain things had happened in a different way. Or are we going through a period of quite tumultuous change where Labour are moving left, and intentionally so, and England is moving to the right? I mean,
I think we are going through huge change, and it's, you know, wonderful to be a political journalist, but I think the facts are still the same, which is that voters vote for the party who they trust on the economy and whose leader they can imagine standing at the European Council summit next to Angela Merkel. And whoever is leader of any party, that those will be the facts. I think for Tim Farron, that the Liberal space that he thinks he's hoping his party can occupy, he doesn't really seem to be able to define it himself. In his conference speech this year, he ended up basically defining a Liberal as someone who's nice and wants to other people to be nice too, which, well,
but I think that's
most of us are sort of
Peter
that.
Candler said to me once earlier this year, you know, the founder of YouGov, that the thing about UKIP or the Greens is that you can define in one sentence what they're about. And actually that's a problem that Lib Dems, Labour and the Conservatives all have. What are they for in just one simple sentence? You know, we know very much what the SNP are for. And I think that that's going to be a bigger problem in politics as people stop seeing their kind of having a tribal loyalty to any particular party, because, you know, we've always been Labour or whatever.
Definition becomes a real challenge. Well, we could explore that for about 10 hours, but we've come to the end of the programme. Thank you both very much for joining us. Who knows what 2016 will bring, and any forecasts will almost definitely be wrong, so let's not do any. But with a possible referendum on Europe and the ongoing Labour saga, there's little sign of those big waves subsiding. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll be back next year. And that's all from me, Steve Richards.
You can download many more BBC Radio 4 programmes for free. Find these at bbc.co.uk/Radio 4.